Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. The last couple of days of the legislative session have been dominated by a growing rift between Governor Kathy Hochul and some top Democratic state lawmakers over the governor's decision to halt congestion pricing in New York City. Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Lawmakers have agreed to a measure to reduce plastic packaging by 30% over the next dozen years, and they were prepared to vote on a bill to ban algorithms on children's social media feeds and prevent big tech companies from collecting kids' data. But those items were overshadowed by Hochul's decision on Wednesday to pause indefinitely the June 30th implementation date of congestion pricing in New York City. The policy, aimed at reducing gas-powered vehicle emissions and helping to fight climate change, was going to be too expensive for commuters to bear, the governor said.
After careful consideration, I have come to the difficult decision that implementing the planned congestion pricing system risks too many unintended consequences.
Many Democratic lawmakers on Long Island and in the Hudson Valley praised the governor's decision, but other progressive-leaning Democrats called it a political betrayal and predicted that the decision would backfire on Democrats who are facing close races in several congressional elections in suburban districts. The governor's announcement angered one of the most powerful Democratic women in the legislature, Senate Finance Committee Chair Liz Krueger. She represents a district in Manhattan where the toll gantries have already been set up to impose the $15 fee and where her constituents welcome the change.
She's got to reverse herself on this. This is a terrible decision.
Krueger says the reversal came as a shock, especially after the governor just last month highlighted New York's commitment to fighting climate change at a climate crisis summit held by Pope Francis.
She just went to the Vatican to talk about her commitment to climate change. I don't think this was part of the discussion with the Pope, that she was going to reverse herself on one of the most important environmental decisions that we were counting on.
Krueger says she believes there is grounds for a lawsuit against Hochul's decision, but could not say who might bring legal action. The governor, who has not spoken publicly since her pre-recorded announcement, is also proposing a payroll mobility tax. It would be imposed on New York City businesses, and it would make up for the $1 billion a year that congestion pricing was to have brought in to finance the MTA. Senator Krueger says there is not enough support among Senate Democrats to approve a new tax on businesses. Senate Deputy Majority Leader Mike Gianaris also condemned the governor's decision. He says the legislature could act to authorize that the $1 billion gap be filled later in an unspecified way. But he says the payroll tax for businesses is dead on arrival.
I think it's safe to say the idea of a payroll mobility tax just for New York City is something that we think is a horrible idea.
Gianaris says with just hours left to go in the session, it's too late to hash out any type of complicated refinancing bill. The dispute delayed voting on final bills. As a result, lawmakers are expected to go into the weekend to finish their business before adjourning for the year. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt for the New York Public News Network.
Meanwhile, New York Governor Hochul's announcement this week of an indefinite pause for the state's congestion pricing program has Hudson Valley officials celebrating the news. The Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard with that story.
Less than a month before the already delayed June 30th implementation, Hochul released a recorded video message.
I have come to the difficult decision that implementing the planned congestion pricing system risks too many unintended consequences for New Yorkers at this time.
The Democrat said while the idea behind the 2019 law was to encourage New Yorkers to use public transit, she said the economic recovery from the pandemic shutdowns is by no means complete. Hours before Hochul's announcement confirming reports that she would reverse her position, the New York League of Conservation Voters rallied to keep the toll hikes in place. NYLCV New York Policy Director Pat McClellan is disappointed by the news.
The worry for us is that This indefinite delay is going to turn into a de facto cancellation of the policy altogether. And I think that that would be a disaster for the MTA, for public health in the region, for New York's climate goals. So, you know, it's a pretty unhappy day all around for us.
But local public officials from both sides of the aisle are celebrating. James Skoufis is a Democratic state senator who represents most of Orange County in Albany. He said his constituents don't have a viable alternative to driving into Manhattan.
So to charge them $15 on top of a $15 George Washington Bridge toll, on top of $20 round-trip gas, $50 to be able to get to New York City, the privilege of visiting Manhattan is an outrage. And so I'm delighted for today's news that there's an indefinite pause.
Last month, a report by State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli found the MTA's funding issues could pressure the authority's capital plan. The Democrats said delays surrounding the congestion pricing implementation slowed down capital work, and funding for capital projects and improvements dropped from a pre-pandemic average of $7.1 billion to a commitment of less than $3 billion. Skoufis is among a number of lawmakers saying the MTA should first look inward to address its funding woes. Governor Hochul said the state is exploring its options.
Given the lawsuits and many other attacks on this process, we've already had to prepare for the possibility that congestion pricing could be delayed. We have set aside funding to backstop the MTA capital plan and are currently exploring other funding sources.
One of the lawsuits came from Rockland County. Republican County Executive Ed Day said Wednesday Hochul's change of position is all about politics.
She's doing an escape route at this point. Because none of the things she raised today is anything new. There was no sudden new issue that came up. These are all the things that we have been saying all along are unfair and wrong, especially for Rockland, the most underserved county in the metropolitan transportation region.
Political reporting swirling before Hochul's announcement suggested vulnerable Hudson Valley Democrats pushed for the pricing pause. Speaking with WAMC, Congressman Pat Ryan, a Democrat from the 18th District and a former Ulster County executive, denied the about-face was politically motivated.
I've been talking about this literally since my first day on the job, and it's all been informed by the outrage and frustration of my constituents. That's not political, that's not Republican, that's not Democrat. That's working people and working families. It's cops, firefighters, teachers, folks who, union workers who have to go into the city for work to provide for their family, who have from the beginning been very upset, rightly, about this plan.
Ryan says a new concept is needed and suggested there must be discounts for public servants commuting into Manhattan, among other facets. Many Democrats who control the state legislature said they were outraged by Hochul's move, which came in the waning hours of the legislative session.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week I sat down with Teresa Roth. She's the executive director of the New York State Children's Alliance. I spoke with Teresa about the organization's mission.
The work is very collaborative, so it empowers all of these people with all these expertise to come together for a mission that is easy for everyone to agree on, which is the safety and recovery of a child who's been abused. So working for a child advocacy center really enforced my devotion to the work of child advocacy centers. And when the opportunity to join NISCA arose, I was really interested in it. The idea of being able to support child advocacy centers statewide really appealed to me. And just a few months in, I can say that I feel like I made the right decision and I'm really enjoying my job.
That's great. It's incredible work the more I read about it. And I guess that's the thing. People, including myself, who is tasked to be informed on everything possible, wasn't as informed as I should be. And what prompted me to reach out to you, we're speaking with Teresa Roth, Executive Director of the New York State Children's Alliance, is an article I read in the Albany Times Union. And here's the headline. This will put a face on the issue for many. New York had hundreds of confirmed abuse cases in public schools last year. A kindergarten teacher in Brooklyn made her students carry a bin of blocks up and down stairs as punishment. A high school math teacher in a Buffalo suburb used a wooden meter stick to hit female students on their legs. A teacher's aide in a school near Ithaca pulled a child's hair so they would, quote, know what it felt like. In other places, public school educators engaged in sexually explicit conversations with students, verbally disparaged them, held them in excessive restraints, pushed, punched, slapped, and spanked them. Now, this is the part that I think the next line that captures what most of us probably think and don't realize. Corporal punishment and child abuse are illegal in New York, and it was made explicit in a new law signed by Governor Kathy Hochul in October that rules also apply to all schools. But I think most people think, well, corporal punishment was outlawed, so that can't be happening in the state schools, but that's happening in more. And you're in this article as well, quoting just what your organization does, this holistic approach to trying to help young people.
Yes. You know, obviously, any type of child abuse is unacceptable, to be perfectly frank. But when you think of it happening within the context of a school, you know, statistically speaking, 1 in 10 children is sexually abused before they graduate high school. And even more children are exposed to physical abuse or violence in the home or neglect. So, you know, on top of my concern about abuse being perpetrated in school, I'm very concerned about the fact that you have these children who, as I said earlier, unfortunately are victimized most likely by somebody that they know, love, and trust, not even being able to feel safe in school, which for a lot of kids, unfortunately, is the only place they could feel safe. So, you know, as I said, it's alarming that this happens in school, but especially disappointing because the school should be a safe place for children, especially those who don't feel safe at home.
Well, let's bring in the mandated reporter part of this, because employees of the school, the public schools, all schools now, I guess, are mandated reporters. If they see symptoms of child abuse or suspect child abuse, they need to report it. And in the article, it pointed out that many of the schools that may have problems often are the ones that don't report a lot. Their numbers are way down, and that's what raises suspicion, not the schools that seem to be reporting what would be average numbers. Numbers, I guess.
Yes. And, you know, it's very difficult. I alluded to it in the article to know for sure whether a school with low reports have low reports because they're doing a very good job of ensuring the safety of their students, or if, you know, unfortunately, there's a reluctance to make a report. And, you know, in that case, a school with a low rate of incidents could indicate a school that's not reporting as they should be. And that's very concerning. In addition to the fact that children who are at risk of any kind of abuse are often at risk of all kinds of abuse. So children at higher risk of abuse, for example, who have a disability or mental health diagnosis, not only are they higher risk for being abused outside of school, they're at higher risk for being abused inside of school. So unfortunately, the kiddos that don't have a good support system at home might not even be able to come home and say, you know, my teacher did this and it hurt me or it scared me, which is kind of a compounding issue where, you know, I'm envisioning children I've worked with over the years that really have no safe haven. And in the absence of schools taking a trauma-informed approach to children's behavior, one victimization could increase vulnerability to another victimization. So, for example, if you've got a young elementary school child who is being abused at home and is concerned about the safety of a younger sibling at home when they're away at school, I have seen situations where that child acts out at school knowing that that's their ticket to get home so they can keep an eye on the safety of their younger sibling.
Oh, my.
And that's heartbreaking to understand that in that case, that's the foundation of the behavior. It's not defiance. It's not, you know, an unwillingness to learn. It's not a dislike for school or their teacher. This poor little child is in a situation where they feel an obligation to protect a younger sibling and know that certain behaviors are going to get them removed from school for the day. So I think it's really important that schools take a trauma-informed approach to children's behaviors. Not, you know, not in a way that excludes a child from consequences, because obviously you need to maintain order for the safety of other children and staff and for a productive learning environment. But, you know, if the approach first is to ask what happened to this child before asking what's wrong with this child, that sets up a very good foundation for really being able to meet children where they're at and to meet their needs and provide them, you know, structure and sometimes consequences in a way that are going to be productive and are less likely to create further harm.
That's Teresa Roth, Executive Director of the New York State Children's Alliance. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gostina. The Albany Common Council has opted in to good cause eviction, the first city in the state outside of New York City to do so. Mayor Kathy Sheehan says the legislation will help set clear protections for both tenants and landlords. It comes after the April passage of a state law authorizing the measure. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas takes a closer look.
Under good cause, rent increases are limited, and landlords are given criteria they must abide by when evicting a tenant. 14 common councilors voted yes Monday night on the measure, with one voting present. Albany had previously passed good cause eviction protections in 2021, but the efforts were halted when a court ruled only the state was allowed to pass the measure. Albany Common Council member Alfredo Ballarin of Ward 11, who introduced the opt-in resolution, is himself a landlord.
It's going to be beneficial for both landlords and tenants, is because if you're a landlord and you own in a neighborhood where you've been surrounded by other landlords that are not taking care of their property and are not being good stewards of their assets, this will encourage them to make improvements to their property. It will encourage their tenants to not be fearful of asking for improvements, which will bring everybody's property values up, as well as tenants and homeowners' quality of life experience up. So I'm optimistic that this is going to not just protect tenants, but also encourage good landlords, you know, to continue to invest in our city and to continue to see a opportunity for growth in their investment.
Kenyon Ryan, Executive Director of United Tenants of Albany, says rents rose 30% citywide from 2011 to 2022.
Our Common Council understands the relevance and importance of good cause eviction and kind of remains on the front line in that fight. I also think it's significant that the timing of this is June, because we anticipate in July that our vacancy study determining whether or not the city can opt into the Emergency Tenant Protection Act, otherwise known as rent stabilization. Those numbers should come out in July as well.
Ryan says the law applies to tenants renting from landlords who own more than one unit in the state. Eligible tenants must be living in homes that are not owner-occupied, built prior to 2009, and rent for below 345% of fair market rent. He adds that tenants can expect an annual rent increase of no more than 10%. Connor Gillis addressed councilors on behalf of the Greater Capital Association of Realtors, saying the group has concerns about the impact on the rental housing market in the city.
Decisions over whether a tenant gets to stay beyond the terms of the lease will be left to a court, requiring property owners to go to great lengths and expense to demonstrate good cause for eviction.
Gillis contends good cause will result in perpetual residential leases, undermining private property rights. Again, Ryan.
Landlords are now going to realize that good cause eviction is back in effect, but I think also probably a lot of them saw it coming, considering that Albany is the first to pass it. It'll be really interesting to see how other cities deal with this, though, because Albany kind of already had this, by definition, kind of alignment on being progressive on housing. It will be interesting to see what other municipalities opt into good cause eviction now that it's completely legal, and how they respond to landlord concerns.
The cities of Kingston and Ithaca are expected to opt in soon.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Riverkeeper is expanding its fleet with the launch of a new boat designed to increase water testing on the Hudson River. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King reports.
The environmental nonprofit christened the vessel, a refurbished 2005 Parker with a new Yamaha engine, at Westerly Marina in Ossining Sunday, naming it after Riverkeeper's late founder, Bob Boyle. Boyle died in 2017 at the age of 89. Tracy Brown, the organization's current president and Hudson River Keeper, says the new addition is meant to honor Boyle and free up space on their main patrol boat, the R. Ian Fletcher. After years of cramming their mobile lab onto the Fletcher or various rental boats, River Keeper finally has a vessel dedicated to lab work.
The key was really getting the capital to buy the boat. That was the big expense, that was the hurdle, but once we owned the boat, then the operation of insuring it and running it and staffing it wasn't really more than what we were paying to have an outside captain and a rented boat and an outside technician do.
Brown says the Bob Boyle cost roughly $150,000, most of it covered by a New York State grant. In addition to the cargo ships that trek up and down the river between New York City and the Port of Albany, the Hudson attracts recreational boaters, fishermen, and swimmers. The river's estuary is a source of drinking water for more than 100,000 residents across seven municipalities, including the city and town of Poughkeepsie, the village and town of Rhinebeck, Esopus, Hyde Park, and Lloyd. So what exactly is the Bob Boyle testing for? Well, science director Shannon Roback says Riverkeeper monitors things like water temperature and salinity. But mainly the new boat tests for Enterococcus, a class of fecal bacteria used by the EPA to measure sewage contamination.
Rock and roll!
Captain John Lipscomb takes me aboard the Bob Boyle for a quick tour of its lab. Every month since 2008, Riverkeeper has collected and tested water samples from more than 70 sites along the Hudson. Lipscomb says those samples are incubated on deck and divvied up into trays containing several tiny wells. To tell how contaminated a particular site might be, he runs a black light over each tray. The wells with fecal bacteria glow bright blue.
And the number of these wells that fluoresce gives you a count. And so then we use this chart. Let me just turn the boat a little so we don't rock too much on this wake. We use this number of small wells, number of large wells, and we can determine the most probable number of Enterococcus per 100 milliliter.
Lipscomb says any count above 60 grants the site a beach advisory, meaning it's not safe to swim in. Each site's counts are mapped out monthly on Riverkeeper's website, and you might be surprised what you find. In May, Lipscomb says 10 sites failed testing, and most of the dirtiest sites were not in New York City, but upstate.
Nyack failed. 908. The Gowanus Canal, the infamous Gowanus Canal, 74. Just a hair over 60. So the infamous Gowanus Canal, the lower intestine of Brooklyn, I call it, was better than Nyack.
To be clear, Lipscomb says Enterococcus is not a serious disease-causing pathogen, but it is sometimes accompanied by bacteria that is. Lipscomb says it's not unusual to see elevated levels in low-volume tributaries compared to giant stretches of river. It's also common for levels to spike in certain areas after heavy rain due to runoff. But the latest NIAC sample was taken during a dry weather run. Lipscomb says he's not really sure why the NIAC levels are so high right now, but he hopes regular tests like these pressure local officials to investigate further.
Unlike climate change, where you have to solve the whole thing to solve anything, with water quality on the Hudson, you can fix a source of sewage runoff in one location and improve that location. And then you can focus on another location and improve that location. So it's a manageable challenge.
Back on shore, friends and family members used the occasion to remember the vessel's namesake. Bob Boyle was a longtime environmental activist, author, and investigative journalist with Sports Illustrated. He founded Riverkeeper as the Hudson River Fishermen's Association in 1966, and over the next five decades took multiple polluters to court. He fought against Con Edison's plans to build a landscape-altering power station at Storm King Mountain, highlighted PCB pollution, its impact on the river's striped bass population, and led efforts to stop the development of the Westway Highway in Manhattan. Lipscomb says Boyle is proof that one person can, in fact, make change in the world. As Boyle's widow, Catherine Bellis Boyle, ceremonially doused the back of the boat with champagne, board member Emmanuel Morlette offered up a toast.
We ask that she possess the wisdom, the strength, and resilience of her namesake. May she serve the needs of the river well and always provide safe passage for all the Riverkeeper captains, crews, and guests. Salute.
Cheers.
Reporting from Ossining, I'm Jesse King.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen to the Legislative Gazette anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2423 and join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.